My guest in this hour is Tara Linhart. Tara is a very well-respected musician, mandolin player, all kinds of music that she writes and plays. She's made this amazing connection between Appalachian music and music in Nepal in the Himalayas. She did a video DVD about it several years ago, the title of which is Mountain Music Project. We're going to talk about that. What she still does, she still goes back to Nepal and recultivates and gets more music and exchanges music back and forth. It's an amazing thing that more people need to be aware of, because she's connected from one side of the earth to the other through music. And it's a wonderful story. We're going to start off with one of her original compositions, Folk Fusion, and then we'll get right into talking to Tara Linhart, who is a friend of mine from over the years. I always let people know that before we begin this. You're going to enjoy her personality, but do not lose sight of the fact that she's a wonderful, serious musician. She just has a wonderful attitude about life and enjoys what she does. But boy, what a great player and songwriter you're going to hear right now in Folk Fusion.
Thank you.
To the audience of Unreal Bluegrass, you just heard a tune entitled Folk Fusion, and we're going to explain a little bit about that with my guest today, Tara Linhart. How are you doing today?
I'm doing just fine. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. There is so much to talk to you about, and we've been meaning to do this for a while, and now seems like an apropos time. I'll mention this. I want to talk about Folk Fusion as a piece of music, and I also want to talk about the Mountain Music Project and the fact that there's a continuation of that effort where you travel, you connect Appalachian music to Himalayan music, which blows my mind. I want to know how you ever connected on those. But let's first of all, we started with Folk Fusion, a tune that will help us get into that broader topic. But tell me a little bit about Folk Fusion before we get any further.
Sure. That is a tune that was written by my good friend Sam Nepali, and he's Nepali. And his last name is also Nepali, which can confuse some, but makes it easier for others. And, he's a great sarangi player. He's a pioneering sarangi player.
Now, okay. I'll break you down to give descriptions of things like that instrument. I want a description of that so we can connect it to the Appalachian hymn. And you were going to do that anyway, but I'm just going to let you know that I want to hear about that.
Sam is a pioneering sarangi player, and the sarangi is the four-stringed fiddle. Traditional fiddle of Nepal. So the musician cast there, the Gandharva cast, play this Gandharva-based, at least, instrument. And it is four strings. It's tuned much like a fiddle. So you think of a lot of Asia as sounding really foreign and having like a million strings. But for whatever reason, I don't know the historical reason, I've tried to find it, but Nepali music sounds a lot like old-time music. And now it's getting more into improvisation, so it's kind of crossing borders into sort of more bluegrass and jazzgrass and raga grass in Nepal context. But yeah, the sarangi's a lot like a fiddle. And Sham wrote Folk Fusion, and it seemed like a really great song to put in our set. So we started playing music together in Kathmandu, and then he moved to the U.S., living in the Boston area now. And we played such amazing venues as the Gray Fox Bluegrass Festival, Himalayan Appalachian fusion, which was awesome.
And that's probably where I first met you, walking around at Gray Fox, and we're all just kind of rambling around. And I know Tara from that venue, from Gray Fox, and I also see her in, or had seen her many times in Raleigh, Carolina for IBMA. You're an instructor, you're a teacher. I often see you when you're doing teaching projects. I'll come back to this Mountain Music Project, but a little more about your musicianship, what you play, what kind of music that you play, and also the fact that you teach music, if you can help me with that a little bit.
Absolutely. So my day-to-day life often revolves around my teaching. So I teach mandolin, guitar, and ukulele lessons. I teach a lot of bluegrass style, but I also teach some gypsy jazz, swing jazz, Irish folk, blues, you know, all of that sort of thing. And I guess I love just doing all sorts of things that inspire people and get people excited about just music and culture and everything like that. So that's sort of the thread that links it all, I guess, is that, if I'm teaching someone to play guitar or mandolin, or I'm bringing someone to Nepal, or I'm making a documentary and showing it. All of those things, I just love that thing where you look out in the audience or you look at your student and you see that spark of like, oh, excitement, you know, or even when I'm performing, you know, when you see that the crowd is like, when I was playing at Gray Fox, you know, there was just so many people that were like really excited. And I'm pretty sure we were the first Himalayan Appalachian band to play there.
I think so. There's been a flood of them since then. But you were the groundbreaking.
Maybe, yeah.
No, there hasn't. So. There hasn't. You're the one and only. And it's just amazing to me. And I will tell you this too for the people listening. I know Tara. I know that she has this sense of excitement and joy in her performances and instruction. So that's a wonderful thing. You connect with an audience. You connect very well, whether it's swing or whether it's whatever you're doing. There's a great connection there. So you're a very good teacher for that reason, I think.
Oh, well, thank you. I do try, and I try to make things fun.
Yeah.
So whether you're doing a lesson or you're doing a lecture or you're you know, leading a tour. I mean, everything should be fun and have a sense of humor, you know, and make people laugh and smile. And if I teach a lesson and I didn't make them laugh or smile somewhere, I feel awkward. I always try to make it enjoyable, you know.
And and you do. And we talked about in-person lessons. You are like so many great teachers. Everybody has availed themselves of online and Zoom and all sorts of. So you're available to do that also, to give instruction.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Luckily, I was really lucky in that I'd already been teaching online lessons for a few years before the pandemic hit. So I'd already digitized loads of materials. So I didn't have to suddenly, because the first little while that one teaches online lessons, it's a totally different world, you know. You can't just jam with them. You have to kind of tweak your technique. And luckily, I'd already been doing that long enough that when the pandemic happened, I was like, all right, let's go online. And I, you know, Googles and Zooms and Skypes and FaceTimes and,
do you agree with me if I make this statement that it's found itself? I think that's never going to go away, even though you do instructions in person, and that's fine. But I think everyone now is comfortable enough from both sides of that window to give a lesson and to take a lesson. I think that's not going away, right?
Oh, it's amazing. It is great because I have taught people from other countries and continents, and I think it's really actually really fun to say, so what's the weather like in Paris today? You know, because it's someone in Paris that, you know, I had a student that she really went in, and there wasn't anyone really teaching that she could find, surprisingly, in Paris with Bluegrass Mandolin that she really liked. So, you know, you get to find out Australia, and I've had people in different parts of Canada. And it's kind of a cool little way to get a window into all these different worlds. People like clicking in from Alabama and California. And
I think it's here to stay. I think it's here to stay. Listen, we'll talk about several websites before we leave. We have more music to play and many more topics to discuss. But if someone wants to find you for lessons for all these wonderful things that you do, what would be the best way for them to find you?
Well, they can always just, if they remember how to spell my name, go to taralinhart.com. And you know, TARALINHART.com. Anyway, they can get me through there and then just email me through that, which is just taraworlds@gmail.com. Yeah.
Okay.
That's for the best way.
All right. Well, let's do this now. We played Folk Fusion. You've given a little bit of filled out that song a little bit. You mentioned a musician class, and you had another word for the class of musicians, and I wanted to back up and catch that up because I'm not sure on what you said.
Right. So probably a lot of people know that, well, Nepal is both Hindu and Buddhist and animist, and it has like at least 100 languages in it, different cultures and subcultures. But it did have the caste system, which a lot of South Asia did.
Right.
And though the caste system was made illegal, I can't remember exactly when, maybe the late 60s or something, you know, it takes a long time. People don't just instantly forget something that was around for a couple hundred years. And it really actually, it doesn't date back as far as it does in India. But anyway, long story short, the musician caste, is a caste in Nepal, which is now, officially, I guess they don't have a caste, but it's still an ethnicity.
Well, it's still going
to
be recognized.
And they have their own language. You
really?
The Gandharva was a language, and you were born into it, and you learned to play music when you were born into that village. So, but they have a lot of great musicians that have come out of it, and a lot of great also instrument builders that I know that have come out of that caste. But what's cool now is to watch how the evolution of that instrument, people are learning that from all over the world. You know, people that are not even South Asian are now learning sarangi and learning Nepali music. And the cool thing is some of my friends in Nepal are even teaching online lessons, well as some of the Gandharvas here or some of the Nepalis here. So if someone wanted to learn sarangi, they could also contact me, and I could hook them up with one of my friends that could probably arrange to get a sarangi shipped to them any place in the world, and they could do online lessons.
Is it a bowed instrument?
Yes. Okay. Yes. It's a bowed instrument, just like a fiddle, except usually they hold it up and down instead of.
Yeah, that was in my mind. That's what I was thinking. I couldn't remember if it was plucked or bowed, but yeah, all right. That makes much more sense to me now.
Right. Okay. And if anyone wants to become a pseudo expert in an hour, if they watch our documentary, The Mountain Music Project, It talks about like what they use for rosin and strings and the wood they use and all of that sort of stuff. So,
well, let's do this because that's a good point to jump off and talk about. There's a DVD and there's music, and you mentioned the Mountain Music Project, which is also subtitled as an Odyssey from Himalaya from Appalachia to Himalaya. So that's a video, and I assume we can find that the same place we find other things such as Tara's teaching classes and things like that, right?
Yeah, okay. Yeah. You can look. It's on Amazon. So, you know, you could buy a DVD or you could just stream it on Amazon. And if you just go to my website and just look under merchandise, there's a direct link. So people, and I made it really obvious and underlined in a different color. So
there you go.
Life's hard enough. I try to make things easy wherever I can.
I think you do. And so we'll talk about that a little bit. We have already just a little bit, but I wanted to know this from you, and I've always wanted to ask you this question. When did you make this connection? I don't know that it was the first time you went to Nepal. That's why I'm asking. Was it the first time you went and you heard this music, and in your mind as a musician, you recognize these correlations, or how does that connect?
Sure. Actually, I went and did my junior year abroad in Nepal, back in the 90s. So, I was going to the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and I knew I really wanted to study abroad, and I wanted to see the rest of, I'm from rural Virginia, and I was, like, very excited about seeing what else is out there in the world. So I did my junior year in Nepal, and the whole time I was there, I kept telling people, even though we're on our year abroad program, there are about 20 of us Americans, and I kept saying, this is so much like rural Virginia. I mean, it is so much. You know, I was living in a rural village. And people were making things, you know, if they wanted something, they would just make it. I lived in a wood carving village, and I studied wood carving, but it was just that resourcefulness and the sense of humor. And there was just so many, you know, the dirt roads and that, you know, the outhouses, of course, and things like that. But most of the people that I knew that had gone to Nepal, either with Peace Corps or with Wisconsin program, something, a lot of them were from like suburban and urban areas. They didn't know that the United States even had an outhouse anymore, much less that the United States had moonshine anymore or bluegrass music or anything. And I kept saying, oh, no, we have moonshine in the U.S. And they were like, we do not. It's in songs. It lives on in legends. But no, it's not. I was like, okay, come to Virginia. I swear. I mean, I don't want to get anyone in trouble, but there is some left. Trust me.
Oh, yeah, it's everywhere. Oh, it's everywhere. Listen, I live in Kentucky. I grew up in Kentucky. I still live there. And I, you know, it's not that big of a
Yeah, we're not dropping names. But
no.
I do think there is some out there. But they make this really smooth, amazing moonshine in Nepal, too. So there were a lot of similarities. And that's, we cover that a little bit in the documentary as well, that it's not just the musics that are similar. There's cultural things. So that's really where it started, was back in the 90s when I was an undergrad. And then I went back to Nepal with Danny Nicely, and I wanted him to meet a lot of my friends there that I had for years, and we ended up playing with some of the musicians and getting a lot of Gandharva friends at that time, and we were listening to what they were playing, and they're like, you know, are they playing Sally Ann? Well, you know, they are. The second part's different, but that first part is Sally Ann.
Really?
For sure. And so we started playing Sally Ann, and they were like, oh, I already learned our song. And we're like, no, that's our song from our mountains. And everyone in the room, Nepalese and Americans, was like, oh, whoa, we have to explore this.
That would be such a cool moment to make that connection. And I'm sure whoa is about the best way you can describe it. But I just think that's a neat thing to hear that.
So the Nepalese were excited too. And then luckily we met Jake Pinchansky when we were in Lhasa. And he had been traveling around recording folk music in China. And we said, there's these amazing similarities between rural, like Appalachia and Appalachian music and Nepali music and Nepali culture. And he said, maybe we could make a documentary. And we thought, that seems kind of weird. Maybe we could make a CD. And so, cause Danny and I know the world of making a CD. And Jake was, you know, anyway, we ended up doing both. So, that's sort of how
it
got born. Over dinner one night in Lhasa is really how the film started.
But. Was there moonshine before or after the concert?
I don't remember the particulars.
By the way, I have that because you sent it to me a long time ago. You sent me the physical. Okay. And it's really, I mean, I'm just telling the people that I already own it. So I just, but I need you to explain it. And the music, you sent it to me a long time ago, I guess shortly
the,
after our past.
The documentary or the
yeah.
CD? That
the document, the documentary that we're talking
okay,
about.
Okay. Yeah. There. So basically we go back and forth between, Nepal and mostly Virginia. But you know, Southern Appalachian area, but being that Danny and I are both Virginians, it's a lot of Virginia. And we interview people on both sides of the planet. I mean, it really is almost the exact opposite side of the planet. And what's interesting is especially a lot of the old timers, you know, we interviewed Mike Seeger and Sammy Sheeler and Two Gun Terry, you know, and Speedy Tolliver's people on this side. And asked how things have changed over the years and how things were. And we interviewed similar types of people, in Nepal, and they're all saying the same things. And I know Jake, who was sort of directing the film, said, you know, when he was writing a sum up afterwards, he said, and we were amazed at the similarities. And Danny and I were like, no, we weren't amazed. That's why we thought it was a good idea, because they're so similar. Yeah, but so that's sort of what happens. And we go back and forth between, a number of times, Galax Fiddlers Convention, because that is one of the things that really inspired, both Danny and I to really start taking music seriously, was the Fiddler Convention situations and scene and world, and Galax, of course, being sure. one of the ultimates of that world, and how I think Danny was inspired to become a real musician, seriously, Galax, Sammy Sheeler, like, I think even Mike Seeger mentions, oh yeah, well, then I went to see, yeah, I was sure. like, whoa, I gotta do this. So,
this is, if you're just tuning in, I'm talking to, Tara Linhart about so many things. We're going from Virginia to Nepal, and it all makes perfect sense if you're paying attention to what she's talking about. The cool thing is, I want you to introduce another song in just a minute, but the cool thing is you're still going to Nepal. You've actually, as of this experience, you go back and you take tours with you, and people can go with you and visit all these places and different things you're talking about.
Yes. And what's interesting is, you know, there's this, the logic of supply and demand that we study in economics classes. And in this case, the demand came before the supply. So I was, you know, I screened, we had our debut of the Mountain Music Project was at National Geographic. And then we played at the Smithsonian Folklife Festival. I played at Gray Fox. We played at a number of universities around the country, arts organizations. And people would come up to me and they'd say, I want to go to Nepal, but I don't want to just be a tourist. I want to meet some of the woodcarvers and the musicians and the instrument builders and the tonka painters and the kids. And I want to get off the tourist routes and I want to go with you. Can you take me? And I kept saying, well, I can't just take every person, every, you know, random person. And then they said, well, why don't you lead a group of us? And I was like, well, I'm not really doing that. And after enough people asked that, I thought, well, why am I not doing that? So I made an LLC and I started a small tour company and I keep it, a small size and I don't just do like, you know, maybe one or two a year at the most so that I don't get burned out and start talking like a tour guide that goes da 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 da, you know, so it's just like a group of friends. Having a really good time and going to people's houses and going into villages and, actually interacting with the artists and the musicians. One does not have to be a musician or an artist or an athlete to come. They just have to have interests in people and culture. So yeah, I definitely have people coming on the trip. Some of them are musicians. Some of them are not.
Some of them may become musicians when they get back.
Yeah, that could happen. Some of them may get inspired. Absolutely.
Yeah, so you're doing this again. The next available opportunity is what, next 2022?
Yeah, I have a trip going in March of 2022, and all the dates and specifics are on the musicartsadventures.com website, and people can always just, you know, email me or if they know me, they can call me or something and I can send out, you know, itineraries and brochures and all that sort of
now
thing.
This, I would think that a trip to Nepal takes a little bit of distance and time and planning. So I wouldn't, if people are listening and thinking, how can I go to there? Also, how can I go to there? To Nepal, they might want to look at that now.
Oh yeah. I have to set up and reserve all, cause you know, I get us into the coolest hotels and interesting places. So, and actually, that's the other thing, is that I like to be comfortable. So we're not like roughing, you know, like the first week is the culture tour week, and we're going to be staying in nice hotels and eating in nice restaurants, and definitely, you know, getting out into the world and into some villages and maybe even seeing some kids in orphanages and stuff. But we're comfortable. We're staying in nice beds. And even when I take people on the optional trekking weeks, I arrange us to stay in lodges. So we still have beds and bathrooms. That's and good. All our meals provided for us. So we don't even have to carry our bags. We have porters, you know. So we just carry like a little fanny pack or day pack with our water bottle and a jacket. You know, maybe a camera if you want to take snaps along the way.
if somebody wants, well, I want to focus on this, and I want you to introduce Cluck Old Hen, which everyone will recognize. But I want to nail this down. If somebody wants to go with you in March, when do they have to make themselves available to you to get into the planning part?
Okay, so if they want to come for this trip, it would be really, really good idea to let me know as soon as possible. I would say, you know, before the end of December. Okay. They should at least touch base with me before December 20th or something. I don't know. Before the end of December, because like I said, I am reserving rooms and guides and porters and all of that sort of thing soon. But they can also sign up if they don't want to come this year. They can send me an email and get on my email list for upcoming opportunities in the future as well. So, they can, even if they hear this later, or I don't know if you podcast or whatever, people can always just email me through either taralinhart.com or musicartsadventures.com and say, oh, please add me to your mailing list, and I can do that too.
The show is broadcast at least 7 times a week on 6 different stations, and since you're now a guest, you'll be on the unrealbluegrass.com website archives for this entire conversation, so you can listen to yourself whenever you want to. Yeah, so let's do Cluck Old Hen. Talk about that. That's one everybody's going to recognize right away. Then I'm going to come back and talk to you for a minute, do an intro for that. We'll come back and talk a little bit more, and then we'll do another song out, and I'll let you go.
Okay, so Cluck Old Hen, I think it's the universal song, and I know Abigail Washburn said the same thing when I played with her and some of the Nepali guys, with Sham and Papoor, at Grey Fox. We met right before we got on stage, and we ended up having Tony Trischka, who's on our CD. The Mountain Music Project CD has Tim O'Brien and Tony Trischka and Mark Schatz, a bunch of great people. Abigail Washburn's one of them.
Abby's on there.
And anyway, we met right before, we had to play. And we're like, okay, what are we going to play? And I was like, Cluck Old Hen. She's like, perfect, the universal song. And she said when she was traveling around different countries, you know, rural villages in China, I found this when I was traveling around India or Nepal or Thailand, different places I've gone. You can pretty much kick off Cluck Old Hen, it seems like, anywhere in the world.
Really?
And the people will be like, oh, yeah, and all the musicians, because it's just very few notes. It's very short. And almost every place has a song that goes almost just like that somehow or
another.
Isn't that
weird? Isn't that weird? I guess it makes sense. I mean, there's only so many notes. Now, I know there's different tunings and different scales as you travel around the world, but there's only so many notes you can fit in there.
Right. And that one is one that's short and it's pared down. But I think actually, we're lucky enough that they're actually, Grey Fox took a video, of the Creekside stage set. And I do believe the Cluck Old Hen is out on YouTube. They could just maybe put in a YouTube search, Cluck Old Hen, Mountain Music Project, Grey Fox. It'll probably come up. But anyway, the universal song, it's like black jeans. It just like seems to go with everything, every place.
You said black jeans?
Yeah. Okay. You know, you can dress them up. You can dress them down.
That's true. All right.
Solo,
you're right. You're
play
right.
It fast.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, let's do that. Let's play Cluck Old Hen, as described so well by my guest, Tara Linhart. And we'll be back in just a second.
Okay, thanks.
was it. That was the universal song, Cluck Old Hen. It makes sense to me. It's just odd for me to think, you know, I'm a pedestrian musician, but it's odd for me to think that so many of those things are recognizable as other things throughout the world where you have different, I mean, China, crying out loud, it's like you don't even think of the musical scale as being the same, and you think of the Chinese instrumentation in general, but I guess that it's just one of those things that maybe they're wondering why we play their tunes.
Yeah. Well, what's funny is in Nepal, more so than any other of the countries I've been to in Asia, the tunes, so many of them sound like our, like old time tunes. We actually did a thing where we recorded just the sarangi player without the drummer or the flute player, which is often in a traditional lineup in Nepal. And we played it for a bunch of old time and bluegrass musicians up and down the East Coast that we knew that we were friends with. We said, where do you think this is from? And they were listening and they were like, it's definitely somewhere around here, but it's, I don't know the tune exactly. And it sounds really similar. And then like we had like John Glick and James Levin, different, you know, fiddlers, and they would be like, is it Ozarks? Cause it sounds a lot like something that we would play here, but I don't know this exact tune. And I would know it if it was here because I know a lot of tunes. So it must be like Smokies, you know, and they would guess, and they would say, no, it's in Nepal. And they'd be like, no, shut up.
Well,
no,
okay, well, let's talk about that just a little. Why is that? Okay, so the similarity of tunes, we beat that to death, but it's just amazing to me. But so totally independent, So although there's some crossbreeding now, I get it, that what influences back and forth, and largely I would say due to your trips and the exposure you've given it, but almost, you know, completely independently growing up and then the sounds, I mean, the music, not the people, but that to me is just still, we've talked about it before, but I still think it's just amazing that here they go. They spring up and you're thinking, no, this is from here. They're probably thinking, no, you're stealing, I'm not stealing, but hey, it's nice.
Right.
Like you said,
right.
When you start playing Sally Ann, they think, oh, we know that.
Well, you know, it's funny that you say it from the tours. So one of the things that I always like to do, when we go on the tours is, you know, I've helped or organized or coordinated or gotten donations together for running music and arts education programs for some kids at orphanages or disadvantaged kids in poor areas around Nepal. And I always try to take at least some of the proceeds from the tours to do just that. And I take donations for that purpose. But there's one orphanage that we visited the last few times with my tour groups. And we hang out with them and we talk with some of the kids and they teach us some things and they play some music for us. And those that do play music, maybe we'll play some music for them if they want to. And so we kind of share. And some of the kids at this particular orphanage are just so musically talented. And so, you know, we let them play with our instruments sometimes. And I ended up, getting, some guitars and mandolins for the kids that really wanted to learn and teaching them while I was in Nepal and then teaching them how to use the internet and giving them a tablet. And so I was giving them online lessons of mandolin and guitar.
Oh boy, that's great. That worked.
Yeah. And then one of the kids, he's like, you know, he's really excited because, you know, living in an orphanage, you can't really just ask your parents, oh, come on, can I have a something, something?
Yeah.
But after we went this last time, I had a really good banjo player along, and he got to try a banjo for the first time. And he said, so question, is there any way you could get us a banjo next? And I said, oh, there's no banjos out here in the mall. I'm sorry. It's like I could find guitars and mandolins there, you know. And I even got them a mandolin that was on a restaurant wall because I realized, oh, this is not a bad mandolin. Can I get this mandolin off of your wall to give to some kids in an orphanage because they really want a mandolin? But banjos are harder pressed. But just seeing it, then when I got them a tablet and we hooked them up with internet and strung a line through the wall and stuff, taught them how to use this tablet and use YouTube, you know, and I gave them instructional.
By the way, Tara's all over YouTube. You can find her doing skits. You can find her doing music. You name it, she's on there. So anyway, go ahead and interrupt you.
Yeah. Anytime. And so I said, yeah, you can put in like, you know, tutorial, instructional. I was teaching them how they could use the YouTube resource to learn music, even when I'm not there, because it really is an amazing, you know, resource. And so I gave them a little cheat sheet of terms in English to, you know, learn, and then taught them how to read tab, you know, little sheet music, stuff like that. But One of the first things this one kid looked up was banjos, and he kept watching banjo YouTubes, and I was like, oh, poor thing. You know, now he's fit, but as he gets older, maybe, and he gets older, gets a job, maybe, we'll try to.
What did you say now? Now he's bit?
Well, yeah, you know, you get that bluegrass bug, and you're just like, huh. And now, you know, he's into playing, you know, fiddle tunes and, G runs and, you know, it's addictive. Once you start seeing it in action, you're like, ooh.
Yeah.
And I think that banjo actually, Evan Sands was on my last trip and he is a banjo player from the DC area. And, you know, almost everyone that saw him and saw those finger rolls was just like mesmerized, like, whoa. They don't get a lot of the Scruggs style banjo, I guess, over there.
So. I wouldn't think so. Although here's a trick, that I didn't invent that. You've probably seen this before. A friend of mine took a small, I don't want to say parlor size guitar, but a small body guitar for me did this. And you take the top string off, you tune it like a banjo from there on and you have to put a HO spike and you have like a kind of a really mellow, I did it to not disturb people in my family when I was playing. So you can have like a guitar sounding that has all the rolls and all the things. You just need to get those little smaller guitar. It'd work on any guitar, but I would think for kids, a smaller one would work out fine.
Yeah, well, we could try that. And one of the things I actually offer for some of the people that do play guitar that want to come on the trip is sometimes I'll say I can, because I always go early to set up extra fun bonus things for the tour. I can go and I can buy a fairly good guitar there for like maybe $120, $125, something in that range. That stays in tune, you know, just a dreadnought.
Yeah.
And then we'll use it for the trip. And then we can donate it to some kids at one of the orphanages or some, you know, poor family. And they're just so excited to get the guitar. And meanwhile, the guitar player from the States is excited that they didn't have to lug their Martin back and forth over there.
Well, that's
I
nice.
Have had people that brought their guitars and definitely, you know, mandolins and fiddles are easy to travel with.
I apologize for trying to tell you how to hook up a guitar into a banjo sound. I don't mean to, because you are the expert. you're the expert in making this connection and making instruments of it.
That was a great idea. Yeah. You know, hopefully we'll bring you on a trip soon and we can do some of those and demo to them, the kids.
I would imagine. Well, we'll talk about that later. I would imagine that some instrument makers ought to be able to donate. Of course, you have to get them there. I'm not going to name any, but all right, that makes sense. That's way, because you got.
Yeah, but see, the thing is, I can buy guitars and mandolins over there. They're not great mandolins.
Yeah, but they're playable.
But they're playable. Yeah, they're enough. Yeah. Yeah, that they can get the idea, and if they get real good, we can figure out something else.
Let's see all this wonderful stuff you've done.
If someone wanted to come that was a banjo player and just bring an inexpensive banjo, you know, we could always donate stuff like that too.
Could someone donate money to your LLC for the purpose of buying instruments while you're over there?
Oh, yeah, for sure. People can give donations to music education programs, and I have a number of different organizations that I've worked with that I can directly put that to use to help either pay for teachers and or instruments, you know, stuff like that, supplies.
All these things you do in the name of joy and music, and you're making all these great connections. I just think it's amazing. And I will tell the listener, again, I've known this is what you're hearing now, this joy and smile is pretty much how she is all the time. So that's great that you have that enthusiasm. And I want you to introduce one more song before we're out of here, and take your time to introduce it. But I think is it called Spider's Run?
Yeah, that's a tune that I wrote, and it's on my CD, which is Tara Linhart Bond Street Sessions, which has been out for quite a while. You know, I was trying different tunes out with my Nepali friends to see which ones sort of fit on their sarangis well and that they really liked, because, of course, as an entertainer, you just want everyone to like everything you're doing. And when I taught them Spider's Run, they were like, oh, yeah, I love it. So we started doing that in our sets. So you can definitely see some different YouTubes of us doing that with Nepali, sarangi, and tablas. It was a good time. So we played it on some of our concerts.
Well, it's a good tune. So with that, that intro from Tara Linhart, we're going to play for the audience, Spider's Run. And then I will say goodbye to you. Hopefully I'll see you somewhere not in Nepal, because I'm not going in March, but maybe things will open up and we can run into each other in different venues and different places and just kind of chat some more about this amazing connection that you've made which I just think is phenomenal. I think it must be an act of love. It must be, you get so much joy from it and you've made this connection musically and you're helping orphanages
really,
and you're doing, it's a wonderful thing. I just can't compliment you enough on what you've accomplished.
Well, I have to say it is really rewarding. And some of the things that I think are rewarding are just, you know, people's feedback. So people that have gone on the trip, a lot of people said, you know, that was life changing. That just blew my
Isn't
mind.
That,
that was so fun. Or that was, I made so many connections, or, you know, I actually made friends in Nepal because I think so many people travel around the world taking photos of something, but they never really feel like they get a connection someplace.
Yeah.
They don't really feel like they made friends. And that's one of the things I really try to target is, you know, so when we go someplace, you really feel like you've met some people there, you know some people. And you really sort of feel like you've tasted a bit of that actual culture there.
And you don't want to live your trip in a viewfinder.
What's that?
You don't want to live your trip in a viewfinder.
Exactly. I mean, you can look at pictures of places around the world
right.
on the Travel Channel or on, you know, the internet. But to actually talk to people and connect with people and interact
that's
with people.
That's the thing. Yeah,
that's the beauty. That's the magic. And Nepali people, honestly, one of the things that always pulls me back is that Nepali people are so fun and so funny and so sweet. That, you know, I've been a lot of places in the world, but what always pulls me back to Nepal is just the people are so fun and so funny and so sweet. And yeah, that's addictive. And I think almost everyone I know, that has been says, yeah, I first went because I wanted to see those mountains in the pictures, but then the people were just so charming and so fun. I keep going back now because I just can't get enough of the people.
Yeah, that's a great thing. Hey, listen, one more thing in the back of my mind. Correct me if I'm wrong. Did you or did you not attempt and did you set a Guinness World Record for mandolins?
Yes.
Let's do this now. Let's get it open and see where we are with the Guinness people. But you tell me, because I remember talking to you about this.
I did. So, see, in 2012, let's back
see,
up.
I remember this stuff. You didn't expect this to come up, did you?
No, it's fine. It's good. It's all good. But in 2012, I did break the Guinness World Record for the largest mandolin ensemble. And we took the record from the Germans who had it, and I don't remember what number. We got 389 mandolins, and we did it at the Galax Fiddlers Convention. I got the idea because I was at a ukulele Guinness attempt that I don't think actually worked, that Marcy Marxer and Kathy Fink had organized in the D.C. area. And I was like, I wonder, there's so many really good mandolin players that go to Galax. I wonder what the world's record was. And I looked it up, and it was 300 and something. And I was like, you know, on Tuesday night, for the mandolin contest, there's more than 350 or 400 mandolin players for something registered. I don't know the exact number, but there's at least that many registered to play every year on a Tuesday. I could try this. So I called a couple friends in North Carolina and Virginia and Maryland that always I always meet up at Galax. And I said, if I do all this paperwork and do this application process to do this, will you help put the word out? And they're like, are you serious? And I said, yeah, no, really, I am. And so I did it and it worked and we were approved. And so anyone that was there and played in the band that I organized, which I think I called it like Tara and the Galax Fiddlers Convention Mandolin Ensemble or something like that. And it's on YouTube. You can watch it on YouTube. Any of those people that were there could just mail off to Guinness and get their world's record participation thing. And some people have it on their wall that says, yes, I broke a Guinness world's record.
That is so
great. Then I got peer pressured into doing it again because then the Greeks on the Isle of Crete took our record at, they got 414. And so people were like, we've got to get the record back for USA. We've got to get it back. And I was like, oh my gosh, you guys, that was so much stress. You know, just like putting yourself out there, calling TV stations and newspapers and radio stations and thinking this could be really embarrassing and a complete failure. But it worked once. And I was like, you know, I think we shouldn't jinx this. Oh gosh. But anyway, I did it again in 2015 and we got 493 mandolin players. All there at the Fiddlers Convention with mandolins tuned up. And I deputized some Mando Marshals. I made little Mando Marshal badges. So I surrounded the group with Mando Marshals, which were all high-level mandolin professionals or mandolin builders. And I said, you know, anyone that's signing in, if you're not sure if your intonation's right, if you're not sure your male is in tune, or you have any questions on chords, the Mando Marshals are here to help. Ask Mando Marshall, and they will have the answers. They'll help you set your bridge,
Mando
whatever
Marshall.
You need. And anyway, but Guinness changed the rules.
Those dirty Guinness people.
And I did everything in my application the exact same. I said, I'm doing the exact same thing, the exact same place. And they said, if you follow your rules, you should be fine. But anyway, when I put all the stuff in at the end, they said it had to be an indoor venue because someone could have signed in and then not played and left. But I videotaped every angle of the sign-in process and of them sitting in the stands and then playing. Anyway, so that was embarrassing. So I sort of like basically hid in my apartment for a week and then called Bluegrass today and said, okay, it was rejected. This is really embarrassing. But, you know, the thing is, if you want to succeed at things and you want to really do some crazy stuff in life, you have to just throw yourself out there sometimes. Yeah. And sometimes you have great successes and sometimes you have not so much successes.
Hey, as far as I'm concerned, on Unreal Bluegrass, you have the record. We don't care about Guinness. We're going to start our own record book.
Well,
and you're going
to
be the
funny thing
holder.
Was that the first time it was hard to get videographers out. It was hard to get the press out because everyone thought this is such a long shot. This is ridiculous. But then in 2015, I had so much press. I had people volunteering to do videos and stuff. And we had much better video coverage. We had, you know, high def, like the YouTubes of 2015 are way better. And maybe that jinxed it. Maybe we needed to be like, maybe we needed to be the complete, like, this will never work, for it to work. I don't know, but we did do it and it sounded pretty good. We played four songs and it was epic. Even if we didn't get the record, I think a lot of people still say, I doubt I will ever get another chance to play with 490 some mandolin players on one song at the same time.
You know
what was kind of beautiful about it though was that there are people that play like lean forward, like, you know, beat mashing bluegrass. There are people that play old time. There are people that play folk. There are people that play Irish, and they're all playing together in one band, probably for the only time in their lives. And so that was kind of, I don't know if I'm just being cheesy, but it was kind of a beautiful thing.
I think it sounds great. And like I said, as far as I'm concerned, you have the record. We don't have many records on Unreal Bluegrass. That's the first one. So we're going to say that you have the record. Those Guinness people can go write their own book.
Yeah,
well, actually,
absolutely.
They do that. We're going to say that's a record. All right, with that, I knew that was in there somewhere, and I had to remember to bring it up. So with that, I'm going to let you go, Tara Linhart. All so much great stuff to talk about, with all the good things you're doing with music, and it's always enjoyable to hear your voice and hear you talk about music because you know so much about it, and you have so much respect in the industry that people know that you're a serious musician who likes to have fun.
Well, thank you so much. It was a real honor to be on your show.
I'm happy to have you. And with that, we're going to play Spider's Run, and then we'll talk to you somewhere down the road.
Okay, thanks so much.
Say bye-bye. at Spiders Run, from the Appalachian Mountains to Nepal, to writing music, to world records for mandolin get-togethers. There's no other person that would do that except my friend. That's Tara Linhart. I'm so glad she had a chance to visit with us and that you got to experience what she conveys in her music, in her travels, and just a wonderful, joyous occasion. Thanks so much, Tara Linhart, for coming on Unreal Bluegrass.